Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
So we turn to 1 Samuel chapter 30. We'll be looking at the last half of the chapter this evening. Last week, just as a quick recap of what we've seen part one of the narrative of destruction that came upon, but this week we'll look at the actual battle that pursued Dale Ralph Davis has a really good understanding of how this passage kind of flows and the structure of it. As you can see, it begins with the destruction of Ziklag as they've come back from Aphek, and David is there sent home from the five lords as God, through his providence, has used these five lords to change the direction of David in going into battle on the side of the Philistines, and he's changed his direction. This godless chapters, we said, not in that God was absent, but David really wasn't seeking God's presence, wasn't after his own heart, but that change at the end of chapter 6 when David strengthened himself in the Lord his God, and not only had a direction change, but a heart change as well. And that turned into seeking Yahweh's guidance, something we haven't seen David do for a while, turning back to God to seek his guidance, as we saw that contrast between chapter 28. Saul was in great distress, and he sought the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him. David's in great distress, he seeks the Lord, but the Lord does indeed answer him. They go down to pursue the Amalekites. The Amalekites, they get down to the brook of Besor, and they divide. There's 200 men that are exhausted from their journey. And then they discover the Egyptian there who's able to take them to the Amalekites. And that's where we ended there, God's providence leading them to this man to be able to lead them to the band of the Amalekites. So now we turn to the other half of this story, where we see almost the reverse of that, the victory coming, the center of this chapter, really quite simply in two verses, the victory, the recovery of what they had taken, the reunion of the troops, reuniting with those 200 people at the Brook of Besor. They appreciate Yahweh's grace throughout this, and then they're back at Ziklag, where they have the distribution. So the first thing that we see is David's victory and the spoils in the first four verses in 16 to 20. And the Egyptian finally leads them to the camp, to the, where they are. And then we see chapter 30, verse 16 to 20. When he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and the land of Judah. And David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day. And not a man of them escaped, except for 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. David recovered all the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his two wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought back all. And David also captured all the flocks and the herds, and the people drove the livestock before him and said, "This is David's spoil." So here, the Amalekites, they stumble upon the Amalekites. This Egyptian has led them straight to there, and they're having this great celebration. They're eating, drinking, they're dancing. I don't think maybe disco dancing is what they're doing, but they're having maybe more of a festival. Not just a short-lived celebration, but one with excessive food. Celebration is used of those who keep, is the word there, that they were eating, drinking, and dancing because of this great spoil, those who keep the feasts. Now, an interesting aspect about this passage is that everything is singular besides the Amalekites. When it talks about the Amalekites, it's always they were dancing, they were spread abroad, they were eating, they were drinking, they were dancing because they had taken from the land. However, when it turns to on the other side, it's always in the singular and it's always speaking about David. That David struck, David recovered, David rescued or delivered, David brought back, David also captured. And even at that end, that verse in verse 20 that says, this is David's spoil. Now we have no idea of the size of the army of the Amalekites. They mention that they took on the Philistines and Judah. Their raid hit both those lands of the Philistines and the land of Judah. So this might be a very large army. It also might be a very small army. We don't get the details of how many there are. It might be a small army because the Amalekites have seized an opportunity because the Philistines are in effect going to war with Israel, who are up near Shechem. And they've just seized an opportunity. When they're all off at war fighting one another, why not just sneak in and take what you can? While all or if not most of the soldiers are left behind. So there is a possibility it's a small army. Therefore, David is able to strike them down. But there's no mention of how big this size of the army is. Now, we need to again revisit the timeline of where we find chapter 30. Chapter 30 happens before Saul has gone to Endor. We've kind of touched on this a little bit. The raid on Ziklag happened while David and the Philistines were was away with the Philistines. The Amalekites came in and took them. And the military is up near Jezreel or another location. So we don't really know. We know that 400 men of the Amalekites escaped, so you would assume that there would be more than 400 men here. There's 600 made the raid on the Gershites, the Grizzites, and the Amalekites in 1 Samuel chapter 27, verse 8. So the 600 seem to do well in a small amount of size, but we don't know exactly how big they are. But we should make note, the second thing, is that they have been caught by this army of David. They have set up camp, they're eating, they're drinking, they're dancing. Again, this is not a party for 2 hours, just as they celebrate one night, as they're ready to go for the next morning. This is a culture where you celebrate for a large amount of time. You spend days, if not weeks, celebrating a victory like this. So you have a large army, most likely somewhat intoxicated, which would, again, make it easier for David and his men. So we are told in 2 Samuel chapter 23 that there is one man was able to defeat, one of David's mighty men is able to defeat 800 men at one time. So it's not impossible that David has struck down the whole Amalekite army by himself, if there is about 800, if not more, people. Joab, Bathsheba, Acta, Tekmonit, these mighty men, Abel, who was the chief of three, was able to take his spear and kill 200 men at one time. So this text that we were looking at here before in chapter 30 of 1 Samuel says that David is the one that does all this. However, there might be a couple of reasons why it's not just David. It's hard to be able to know for sure. But in verse 21, it explains that David came to the 200 men who had been exhausted, that David came with these 200 men, and then later it's explained that David is there with the 400 men complaining about the victory. So here it just says that David comes to the 200 men. It doesn't say David comes with his 400 men. And then they explain that we're not going to give them any spoil that we have recovered, that it's called David's spoil, But here it's explaining it as our spoil that we have recovered in verse 22. So the other point you might want to make is when David got 200 foreskins to marry Michal in chapter 18, David went along with his own men. He killed 200 of the Philistines. David brought their foreskins, and they were given a full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter, Michal, for a wife. So here's an example. David goes out. He takes his men with him, but he is the one that is attributed these 200 foreskins. So all that is somewhat of a rabbit trail. We can somewhat, at least, that David is mentioned because of his leadership. If not, he didn't strike down all the Amalekites. We see David's leadership in this campaign, in this victory. And you might even say, on a simple reading, that David actually single-handedly defeated this camp of the Amalekites. Remember the song that is so popular in this year, the pop culture song, that Saul has killed his thousands and David has killed his tens of thousands. It's not impossible that David is able to wipe down these whole camp. You remember Jonathan, when he goes into the garrison of the Philistines. Jonathan's there, and he's able to wipe out a whole garrison of the Philistines with two people, Jonathan and his armor bearer. So here, the highlight is that David is the one, if not doing the leading, David is the one who is doing the defeating. David is the one who delivers. David is the one who rescued. David is the one who has recovered those who are captive. And even, I think you can start to see some notes of the gospel. You don't want to overstep here and just say this is a one-to-one correlation as an example of Christ, but I think there is some connections where you see Christ coming in and Christ defeating Satan on our behalf and Christ then being able to give the spoil. Christ is the one who has rescued. Christ is the one who has recovered what we have lost in Adam. You can see those undertones. If not jumping too far and saying this is exactly what it is, I think you can see those undertones here in this passage. So now David has his spoil. The men are there with him. Now we turn to verses 21 to 25, where we see the reunion of the divided in verses 21 to 25. And David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left to the brook of Besor. And they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near to the people and greeted them, and all the wicked of the worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except that each man may lead away his wife and children and depart." But David said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." And he made it a statute and a rule for Israel from that day forward to this day. So they go and make their way home. They've recovered their wives and their children and all the things that have been taken. There's nothing that has been lost, we are told. He recovered everything. Nothing was missing. So they're able to go down and head towards their home. And they come back to the brook of Besor, where these 200 men who were exhausted from their 60-mile journey from Aphek to Ziklag and then probably another 30 miles further down to this brook of Besor. And they come back and they recover these 200 men. And most likely, still at this point, the Egyptian is still with them. And we're reminded that the Egyptian was left for dead in the middle of nowhere. And here the Israelites come up, particularly David, and they give him food and they give him water. Before they even know who he is, they revive him. And here they come back and their men are well and healthy. And this contrast is how David has treated his men compared to how the Amalekites treated theirs. But they come up and they were united with their men at the camp. And we're explained that there's these wicked and worthless men within these 400 men that are with David that come up and explain that they can have their children and their wives back, but they can't have anything else. They didn't do anything in this fight. So I guess they can have their children and their wives, but they can't have any of the spoils that we got. Now, let's just make a few comments on this. This seems to imply a portion of the men, not all the men, we don't have idea about how many of the 400 men are wicked and worthless. It doesn't seem to imply that all the men who were with David were wicked and worthless. It implies that there were men there that were wicked and worthless, but all of them got together. The text explains all the wicked and worthless men got together, but we don't know how many. It could have been a band of 3, a band of 10, a band of 50. We're not sure how many of these men are wicked and worthless. So we don't know exactly how many of them are here trying to make a coup, maybe upset David. We don't know that information. The second thing we need to pick up on is this word is not the first time we've come across this word in the book of 1 Samuel. It come up several times, actually, with the book of 1 Samuel. First time is Hannah explains that she is not worthless. When she explains in 1 Samuel 1:16, "Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I have speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation." Here she is crying her heart out on the steps of the temple, trying to pray to God for the anxiety and vexation that she's faced. Peniah is tormenting her, but she says, "No, I'm not. I'm not. Don't view me as a worthless woman." What you see is a woman facing great anxiety and vexation. But it's also used of Eli's son, Hophni and Phinehas, in 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 12. And the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. Nabal, another example where it's used in 1 Samuel 25:25. Lord regards this worthless fellow, Nabal, for his name is, so he is. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. "But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord, whom you sent." Remember that statement that here, Nabal, can you remember the words that Nabal said when he was asked, "Can we share in some of what you have? We've been protecting your sheep." Not necessarily in battle, but we've been protecting your sheep. And Nabal turns around and says, "No, it is mine, mine, mine." And now what we see here is a similar thing within this band of brothers, within these 400 men. What are the men saying? "Well, no, we can't share it with them because whose is it? It is mine, mine, mine." They're exactly like the worthless fellow Nabal, who acts in his foolishness, not in his wisdom. And that's who they are. "Who shall take my bread," Nabal says, "my water, my meat?" Who are these men that deserve this? And we see this in the camp of David with these 600, 400 men that are there. Again, we don't know how many are these worthless fellows. We know all of them went up to David and spoke to him. We don't know how many there are. But here, these group of 400 men, and we still have worthless men. Worthless men like Hophni and Phinehas, who don't know the Lord. Worthless men like Nabal, who are foolish, who seem to ignore God, His provision, and claim, "It is mine, mine, mine." Yeah. And David actually explains later how useless they can be. In 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 6, he says, "But worthless men are all like thorns that are thrown away, for they cannot be taken with the hand." So, here you have a worthless man. What is a worthless man worth? It's like a thorn. They serve no purpose. You throw them away immediately. No one holds on to a thorn and thinks this is going to come in very handy one day. And this is what David says they are. And maybe there is just a slight undertone. This is what Paul is talking about when he says that there's a thorn in his flesh, that there's a worthless man in his flesh. Now, I'm not going to go into that conversation, but that is a possibility, that this worthless man is what it is. But their basic principle is they didn't fight, so therefore they don't deserve the spoil. So, but if we go back to the first point of what we were looking at, what it says is David went in, David rescued, David struck them down. Even if you weren't arguing that David did all of it by himself, David did the majority of it by himself. You could definitely, I think, feel that strong connection there. So if David did most of the work, then why do they deserve, these 400 men deserve anything? It is, in fact, called David's spoil in verse 20. But David doesn't turn and then turn proudly. He doesn't turn around and explains that, well, what did you do? How many did you strike down? How many do you have to your name? Let's divide it up equally, because basically that's what you would have to do if you were to follow this progression. It's not so much about going into battle, it's how helpful you are in battle. If you're going to look at how you look to it, and David deserves most of the credit, so David should take all of the spoil, if not most of the spoil. But then David turns and explains, "You shall not do so, my brothers. With what the Lord has given us, He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage, and they shall share alike." And again, David could turn quite now and quite arrogantly, proudly, explain, well, how many did you kill? Let's try and get our abacus out or whatever they used and try and count what percentage of the share you have. But he doesn't. He turns it back and gives glory to God. Again, last week we looked at that David didn't seem quite himself, but he was strengthened himself in the Lord, and he turned back to a man after God's own heart. And again, we see this leadership here the same way, that he talks again like the David we know. He doesn't take credit for it. Remember the first time when we saw David in battle with David and Goliath? And David quite often explained that it wasn't because of his victory, it was because what God was doing through him. That God was merely using him in his weakness. That God is the one who is strong. And here we see the same thing. What shall we do with what God has given us? That God preserved us. And God gave these Amalekites into the hand of us. Why would we listen to you? And he says this statement, which becomes law, this statute, which explains basically whoever goes into battle, and if you stay with the baggage, then your share will be the same. He shares the principle of what God has given us. It's exactly what James writes in James 1:17. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. And all these things, God is the one who gives. And the principle of the worthless fellows is they did not do it, so therefore they don't deserve it. Let them have their wives and their children. But David's principle is quite different. David's principle doesn't just look at the horizontal, it looks at the vertical. And the principle basically goes that God is the giver, not only of the spoil, but also you see the gratitude of David, not only of what we have, physical things, but also how God has preserved us. God has spared us our life, that even not the spoil is the only gift, but our life is a gift as well from God. Since God is the giver, then nothing is mine and everything is His. So therefore, the principle then says, we should do with it what He wants us to do, not what I want to be able to do. I probably use this example quite often because it happens quite often in our house. We have the example of what God gives us and the closed fist, what's held close to our chest and the open hands. And often the conversation goes something like this. Whose is that? The argument on their side, it's mine, mine, mine. They're speaking like Nabal. But we have to explain that every good and perfect gift comes from God. That it's not God's. It's not ours, it's God's. And how does God want us to handle this toy? Does He want us just to hold it so close to our chest that no one enjoys it? Or has God shared it with us and therefore we should share it with others? But also this principle goes a little bit further from that, not just what God gives us, but that every person has their part. Even the person at the baggage has their part in the battle. If you didn't have people standing and looking after the baggage, then you would lose what God has already given you. You would not be able to defeat as many people. Think of going into war and having your, you know, wheelie suitcase behind you as you're trying to carry and fight. It doesn't work out that way. But here we see, again, that principle goes further, that not just that everything is God's, but everyone here serves the broader picture. That's exactly a battle against the Midianites in Numbers. The Lord said to Moses, take and count the plunder that was taken, both of man and of beast, you and Eleazar, the priest and the heads of the father's house of the congregation. Divide the plunder in two parts, between the warriors and who went out in the battle and all the congregation. Again, if it's God's, and we see this principle at work in the Promised Land, as they go in and it never becomes a tribe's land. It always remains God's land. And that's where it comes back to the year of Jubilee. You get to give the land back because it was never yours in the first place. It's always God's. Always God's land. And therefore you do with it how God instructs you to. I've mentioned before that I've watched Formula One. I like Formula One racing. And it's often that you have very good drivers. And very good drivers land in very good teams. And people often will explain that it's because a driver is in a team that they win. And it's very true. You could put a good driver in a bad car, and a good driver will get the most out of the bad car, but it still is won and lost by the team. And often that's the case. That a person winning the race still needs to come into the pit stop. And still needs the pit stop to be able to help them. They still need the better car. They still need the faster pit stop. And most of the time, I would argue that a race is decided not by a driver, a single person, but a team. When a wheel gun stops working and a tire cannot remove. And here, this is the principle that we see in this passage. It's not just about David. It's not just about those who go into battle. But all of them are winners in this battle. And David says, all of them helped us win the battle. So what do you then do with what God has given? What God has provided in verses 26 to 31? And when David came to Ziklag, he sent part of his spoil to his friends and the elders of Judah, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. It was for those in Bethel of Ramoth, of those in Agem and Jatar, at Aroer, in Siphmoth, in Jeftimoah, in Rakal, in the cities of Jerahmeelites, in the cities of the Kenites, in Hormah, in Bor Ashan, in Akpak, in Hebron, in the places where David and his men had roamed. And we see here now even further that David's generosity goes further than merely just sharing the spoil amongst the others. That David even sends his spoil to his friends. Now this is an interesting phrase, the friends, the elders of Judah. He sends this to. That David doesn't only give them his spoil to those who are not in battle, those who are guarding the baggage, but even those who have helped him beforehand, before even reaching the battlefield. It says there in the end, for all the places where David and his men had roamed. You could argue that the men in the baggage department, the baggage department of the army of his 200 men or something, they were a part of the battle somewhat. But these other men, these other people that received gifts, these friends that are mentioned, have no reason to be able to really call and to earn their gifts. But he presents them to 13 places where he has traveled to, where he has stayed at. And I think it shows David's understanding of the gratitude in which he thanks God for that he's those who have helped him as he's fleed from Saul and literally running to and fro. In the many places where David has lived over the course of time, there are many people who were not like the men in the wilderness of Ziph, that we didn't know any of these places really before. Where David has stayed, where these people have given it. We've heard about the people in the wilderness of Ziph, who he went and lived in Ziph, in the wilderness of Ziph, and they went and told Saul immediately, twice. And here David, 3 or 4 or 5 days before, wanted to go into battle with the Philistines. But then, God through His providence changed his course, changed his direction. Instead of going up to the north, he goes south. And David, God had turned this depressing time, I'm sure, for David not to be able to fight, to be able to go back to Ziklag. But God, in the end, gave David more than he ever thought or even sought. Like I said, that this utter change of direction, not merely just from north to south, but his heart back to God, where he strengthened himself in the Lord his God. This change of direction where he had lost everything, so it seems, but God still provided for him. I mentioned before that you can make quite a strong connection to Christ in subtle ways, and I think there's another way you can, especially with his spoils and then giving his spoils to his friends. Psalm 68 explains, "You ascended on high, leading the host of captives in your train and receiving gifts among men, even those the rebellious, that the Lord may dwell there." And here, speaking of those who come in, captives in your train, those who have been defeated as you march back into the city with the battle, with the victory, a big celebration that occurs there, and you bring receiving gifts among men. And Paul actually quotes this psalm in Psalm 68. Now, in Psalm 68, it's talking about the Lord. Now, one of the interesting things when you're meeting with a Jehovah's Witness or something is to turn them to an Old Testament passage like Psalm 68 and explain, who is this talking about? And their answer has to be Yahweh, or as they would say, Jehovah. And then you say, well, let's look at the New Testament. And who is this talking about? And they would say Christ. And then, well, did Paul get it wrong? But often it would happen that Paul quotes Old Testament passages that are specifically talking about Yahweh or Jehovah, and he'll attribute them to Christ, saying Christ has done this. And here is the passage which is quoted from Psalm 68 in Ephesians chapter 4. And it says, therefore, it says, whenever he ascended on high, he led the host of captives, and he gave gifts to men. And saying he ascended, what does it mean? But he also descended to the lower regions of the earth. He who descended in is the one who also ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and the teachers to equip the saints with the work of ministry and the building up of the body of Christ. So here, Christ goes, Christ defeats the enemy, Christ comes back with his spoils, and he then distributes his gifts, these gifts, as he said, these gifts, and he gives them to men. And Paul's example of this is a Christ ascended and descended to lower regions of the earth, and he might fill all things, and he gives gifts, and he gives gifts to the church. And these spoils which Christ gives are the gift of apostles, prophets, evangelists, shepherds, and teachers. And the reason he does them is to then be able to equip the work of ministry, the building up of the body of Christ. So we here see that Christ comes down, he defeats Satan, he takes the spoils, and he then be able to gives them to the church to be able to equip the saints for ministry. And I think that's a loose connection, I think, that Paul doesn't turn back and use this passage in 1 Samuel 30 for his example. But we see Christ and his generosity, what truly is his, he shares. And Ephesians explains that very well. That all the riches, the inheritance which is given in Christ is then passed on to us because we are adopted into his family. And this is the example of what Christ has done. And here we see a slither of that in David's generosity in taking his spoil and distributing that amongst the elders, distributing that amongst people who have helped him in the past. But this is a very interesting passage considering where the direction was going. Chapter 26, chapter 27, chapter 28, it seemed to be moving in a certain direction. You would never have then guessed that it would have been fought with the battle of the Amalekites compared to the Philistines or the fighting for Judah with Achish and Gath. You would never have really guessed that. But God's providence through this, I think, is laying that way for that big battle to happen, which the media of Endor tells, that Saul is going to die that day. And God is laying the path now to be able to show that David's change of heart. David is that king who's going to sit on the throne, like we've been told. And David's a king after God's own heart, which is the big question that we've been looking at in 1 Samuel.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.